I'm Christy Valenti. I work at Fantagraphics Books. I edited Bill Shelley's book, which is, he's our lovely...
advanced copy. They're not available yet, but they'll be out in about a month. Kind of heavy.
And Bill Shelley is a comics historian. He's specialized in the history of comics fandom. And Gary Groth is here to moderate this panel. Gary worked with Harvey Kurtzman, so he'll have lots of great stories. And Bill obviously has a lot of great stories in these 200,000 words. So there you go.
Just trying to get high. How's it going?
This is more confusing than San Diego, if I can be believed.
Do you mind if I record this and put it online?
No. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, there you go. Yeah, there you go. Then you can just like click. Or,
well, I'm just going to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, and thank you, and welcome, and thanks for the introduction, Christy. Can I have a show of hands as to how many of you know who Harvey Kurtzman is and roughly what he's done? Okay, so we have a pretty knowledgeable crowd here. Well, Bill has spent between 2 and 3 years, or more than that?
Actually, April 4 years ago, exactly 4 years.
Okay. So Bill spent 4 years researching and writing this biography of Kurtzman. Which I think is an immense task and an incredible achievement. I think it's right up there with David Michaelis's Charles Schulz biography and R.C. Harvey's Milton Caniff biography in terms of one of the best biographies of a cartoonist ever written. So I think what we're going to do here is we're going to go through slides and talk about Harvey and talk about his work. And maybe, Bill, I can ask you some questions about your research and add details, the details you've learned through your research as we go through the slides and just talk about Harvey's accomplishments as a cartoonist and his significance and his contributions to American culture.
Sounds good.
You want to start?
Yes, we can. Let's just start.
No, I haven't actually seen this. But.
Yeah, Gary hasn't seen the slideshow, but believe me, he's seen the stuff that's in it. It's just he hasn't seen quite...
I just haven't seen a sequence like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, exactly, but... That's Harvey Kurtzman toward the end of his life. That's what he looked like then. And he...
That would have been around 1990?
That was about 1990. And this is how he used to sign things. He developed his signature in the late 1940s, and it became something that he did for the rest of his life. And his most famous piece of artwork is the Mad logo. He designed it, he drew the drawings in it, and that logo, that basic shape of that logo, is still on Mad today. So everybody's seen a piece of Harvey Kurtzman's artwork, whether they know it or not. And, of course, a lot of people learned about Mad from the Mad paperbacks. I mean, there were millions and millions of these paperbacks printed in the 60s and 70s. In fact, that's where I first heard Harvey Kurtzman, or actually saw his work. I didn't know who it was until later. Because they had erased his name from the credits. So a lot of people didn't know who he was at that time who were reading these books. But he started his career at the High School of Music and Art in New York City, a special high school dedicated to educating talented young people in the five boroughs of New York. And he was selected. He submitted a portfolio, and he started in high school when he was 12 because he had skipped a grade. And he met many of the people who would work for MAD in high school. So actually, the genesis of MAD starts right there.
And the High School of Music and Art was an incubator for cartoonists back then. So many cartoonists went through that. And of course, most cartoonists lived in and around New York and attended that school.
Sorry, I jumped ahead here. Yes, it was. And when he got out of high school, about that time, a lot of people were being drafted. A lot of young men were being drafted. And he was only 16 and 17. He was able to get into the comics field because so many men were disappearing from it. So as a boy, he started drawing these crude comic books before World War II. And here's another one. And actually, he wasn't too bad. But, of course, none of this is what you would call superlative work. But it's how he started. And then came World War II. And he went into the military. And when he came out 28 months later, his work had matured considerably. And he started doing comics for Stan Lee. It was called Timely then. Now, of course, it's Marvel.
Now, did he do a lot of work during his Army stint?
He did a lot of work. He worked in the Morale Services Division doing propaganda posters, various kinds of pamphlets and brochures, all kinds of things like that for the military. And, of course, that helped hone his skill. In fact, he even did a comic strip for the base newspapers where he was at one point. So he was doing comics during the war. But he started doing, and he very quickly developed his humorous work. That was the first thing he did that you could really recognize was his style. Pigtails, and then came a comic strip called Hey Look. And he did 150 of these one-page comic strips that were fillers. And Stan Lee didn't care what they were because they were just fillers. So Harvey Kurtzman had carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, and he started doing some nutty things. You can see the black and white artwork there. And he created this strip with these two little characters. In this case, I thought I'd show some panels so you could really see what it was like. Here they're going to go diving and compete and see who can do the most flips. 2, 5. And they keep going and going. And 100. And suddenly Harvey leans in saying, "And if you go down to the pool right now, they're still flipping." And so this is how he would do breaking the fourth wall. He would actually, the reader would suddenly realize that the guy who's creating it was admitting that he was creating this comic book and it actually became part of it. And that's the kind of way he would twist and turn the medium in different ways that was unique.
And you can see how enormously his approach evolved and changed and improved from the earliest stuff you showed, which would have been around 42
and 43. And
then after he got out of the Army. And, you know, not only did the technique improve, but he obviously created an identity. He created an identity for himself.
Yes.
I mean, he became the cartoonist he was on his way to becoming.
Right. This is when he had really begun to find himself. And when you have complete creative freedom, that was the key. In fact, that was the key to his whole creative life. He needed to have as much freedom as possible to do his best work. And when he had that, he created stuff that was just amazing. And but at a certain point, Hey Look ran out. And Stan Lee didn't want any more of them. And Harvey was struggling a little bit until he walked in the door of William M. Gaines, publisher of EC Comics. And that was in 1949. This was just when they were starting to plan their horror comics and plan their science fiction comics, but they hadn't come out yet. And Harvey got a chance to try out, and this was his tryout page, for a story called House of Horror. Now, here's a guy that did only humorous artwork. And look, immediately, he's doing this really good, serious type of work. And here, he even said he was trying out. He said, "I etched about every flake of paint on that house in that splash panel because I wasn't going to miss this opportunity. He needed a job, and this was his chance." And he really went for it and got it. And so he ended up doing horror stories and science fiction stories for EC for a while. Things like The Giggling Killer a science fiction story called Lost in the Microcosm that was in the first science fiction comic ever published by EC.
Did Harvey do the title lettering in his stories?
He did it, the title lettering, but he did not write this script. This script is actually ripped off from an old science fiction story. But
but I think you can see where the title lettering is just all of a piece. It's like Harvey's...
Yes. Right, it's part of the artwork. Yeah. It's part of the design. And then at a certain point, he decided that he wanted to do more. He wanted to write, he wanted to draw, and he was able to convince William M. Gaines to give him that chance. When Gaines needed a new comic book, Harvey pitched the idea of a war comic book, or a comic book about adventure that quickly became an all-war comic book. And, you know, war is a tremendous backdrop for all kinds of human situations, in dire danger. So it's a great tapestry for someone to write stories about. And at that time, the Korean War had started. So, you know, war was on everybody's mind. And Harvey took a rather different, unique view of what kind of war comics he was going to do. These were anti-war comics. Another was Frontline Combat. And his style had begun to become simpler, more emphatic. And you can see how stylized it was. It was like, this wasn't the way a gun really looks like, but it looks like a gun from a sort of a subjective, emotional standpoint.
Felt like a gun.
Yeah, it felt like a gun. And the other thing he did was he did stories that humanized, showed that the enemy was human. It didn't mean didn't have to fight him. And a key story here is Enemy Assault, where a soldier is really looking at the enemy like they're, you know, little stick men in an arcade game. And they're not real to him. But then through a certain circumstances, he ends up in a foxhole or in a trench with one of the enemy soldiers. And it turns out that that fellow had been in America. He spoke English and started telling him about his family. And he realized this is a real person. This isn't just some faceless, evil stick figure. And yet, when it came down to it, North Korean soldier tried to kill him, and he had to kill the guy, because after all, like he said, you can't fight a war by comparing baby snapshots. He had a duty to do, and that guy was going to kill him, so he had to respond. Now, this is a pretty sophisticated idea for a war comic book in 1952 or 51. And the way he worked with his artist was unique, too. If you look at this, that was on the left, you see his layout. Harvey would tell the artist through his sketches how he wanted the panels to look. He had that much control over what he was doing. So even an artist as good as Johnny Craig or Jack Davis, they would follow Kurtzman's layouts. And
they didn't know.
They didn't always
they didn't
like
a choice.
It. Yeah, they had no choice, and some of them chafed at it, and others realized that they were getting a better product that way. And so Kurtzman would work this way for the rest of his life by providing layouts, and he did less and less of the finished art itself and more layout work.
I think the artists either loved or hated him.
Right. And even when they hated him, they loved him because they saw how good he was.
Yeah.
And then he also developed really interesting advanced storytelling techniques. Like, this is one of the last stories he did the finished art for. It's about a soldier sitting on the side of a river contemplating a corpse that he sees floating down the river, wondering how that corpse got there, who that person was. And you can see how he developed these three-panel, this like triptych, this three-panel progression to show time passing, even though he's showing the corpse from the same angle. And this kind of storytelling technique is considerably more sophisticated. And what happens is suddenly the soldier who's watching this corpse gets attacked by an enemy soldier and finds himself having to hold that soldier under the water. And you can see how he used the multiple panels to show to slow the passage of time. It's almost like it's in slow motion. And how this soldier feels pretty bad about what he had to do. But, you know, the war stories, he did so much research, it was very difficult for him because authenticity meant everything to him. And so he got kind of burned out on them, and finally he just had it, especially when he was doing these war comics that had four stories that all had to tie together. So he had to figure out how everything was going to tie together, and it got to be a more and more elaborate process. And at some point, he just felt he wanted to advance in another direction.
Can you go back to that cover?
I sure can.
Yeah, the word heck, he hated that.
Did
he? Yeah, he wanted that to say hell.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, somebody basically said, either, you know, it's not going to get through that way if you don't want to do it that way.
Okay. Yeah, it seems a little corny, and I think he felt that, too.
I mean, obviously, no soldier in that position is going to say heck.
No. And this was before the Comics Code, so it could conceivably have said hell, but the publisher wouldn't permit that, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, he needed something to do, and at a certain point he thought, you know, my humorous work doesn't require research. I don't have to spend hours at the New York Library or interviewing soldiers or going to the Korean embassy or whatever. And he invented something else. That's called Mad. And that's the first issue of Mad in 1952. It started as a comic book. A lot of people don't know that. He did the cover, and he came up with the tales calculated to drive you mad, and he came up with the side strip humor in a jugular vein. And the thing is, no one expected anything of Mad. There'd never been anything like it. The publisher just figured it'd give Harvey a chance to make a little extra money without having to do so much research. No one really ever dreamed what it would become.
Now, how important do you think Elder was to Harvey's conception of humor and to Mad itself?
Well,
because they were very close.
Yes, they were very close. They were shared a studio together several years before this. And Harvey was the one that realized that Willie Elder, he had such a goofy personality. It seemed like he'd be perfect for humor work, but he'd never really done it before in comics. He'd been doing other kind of stuff. And when he unleashed Elder's talent for humorous cartoons, he ended up with becoming the number one artist in Mad, because he really embodied the anarchistic spirit of Mad. Yeah, I mean, I think that he was the number one artist of Mad, really. And Harvey would let him do things in the stories he wouldn't let other artists do. He gave him freedom he didn't give other artists. And, of course, it's interesting, his first panel in Mad has a spooky house just like his first panel in my first horror story. That psycho house, I guess you'd call it. And he would do the covers, and the first few issues didn't sell too well, but in issue 4, there was a story called Super Duper Man. And with that issue, Mad started selling. They started getting these reports going, oh my God, it's taking off. And here you have Superman punching an old man in the stomach, and you see all these little figures around. That's Wally Wood art, of course, based on Kurtzman layouts. And so the people who published Superman wrote him a letter saying, don't do that. We don't want parodies of our characters. And he just ignored that. And at the end, of course, Superman is pursuing Lois Payne, and she says, I don't care if you're Superman, you're still a creep. And it doesn't matter, Clark Kent, if you're Superman. But they did Batboy and Robin, and they would do started doing movies like Ping Pong. And if you'll notice this, all the activity at the bottom of the panel, Willie Elder called that chicken fat, because he said chicken fat is the stuff in the soup that's not good for you, but it's the best part. And in that chicken fat, you'll find things like the helicopter chewing up the side of the panel, and a hand coming out of a guy's mouth, and a guy on a pogo stick or whatever. And so the readers of Mad used to read the story, and then they go back and read through all the chicken fat and all the little gags, and people would read them over and over, and it just made the comic book so much more fascinating. And this was really Willie Elder's doing, not Harvey Kurtzman. They did Starchy. Starchy is a juvenile delinquent, basically. And then, of course, Mickey Rodin. And as Harvey said, you know, after all, Mickey, really, what is he? He's a rat, or he's a walking rodent. I mean, he's wearing gloves, and it's just kind of bizarre. And Donald isn't wearing any pants. And Mickey Rodin is probably one of his best known satires from the comic book version of Mad. Now, Life magazine in 1953 looked like this. Mad in 1953 looked like this. This is Basil Wolverton doing The Most Beautiful Girl of the Month, and he did just a few things for Mad. But see, here you have him parodying a magazine cover on his own publication. I mean, I don't think anybody would ever mistake this for Life magazine, but it wasn't the same size. That's the main thing. And he started doing movie satires and started doing the kind of things we think of when we think of Mad now. Scenes we like to see. Ripley's Believe It or Don't, I guess. All this leading up to the first magazine issue of Mad in 1955, Harvey was convinced that Mad should be a magazine. He always wanted to work on a magazine. He'd always wanted to get out of comics and do magazine work. So finally, he was able to convince Bill Gaines to convert Mad from a comic book to a magazine. And this is the very first one, which, you know, he started using these caption covers on many of his books. This new magazine is vital for you to read, and inside you will find an extremely important message from the editors. Please buy this magazine. And that's Kurtzman art. That's actually finished Kurtzman art there.
Well, Harvey hated comics. He hated the whole industrial nature of the comics industry.
Yeah.
And he was always trying to get out of it.
But he didn't hate the comic book sequential art form.
He loved that. He just hated the industry that had grown up around it.
Right, and the way the artists were treated. And
he hated everything about it. He hated the quality of the reproduction. He hated the infantile editorial restrictions. You know, he hated the social status.
The paper that it was printed on, cheap paper.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say payment. He hated that too. Oh. you know, and I think it's also worth mentioning that Harvey is probably one of the best editors in the history of comics. When he created Mad, he recruited four of the best artists working at EC Comics who drew both dramatic and humorous work. That was Jack Davis, Will Elder, Wally Wood,
John Severn.
Johnny Severn.
I mean, he cherry picked the best artists for Mad.
Yeah, but he had an incredible eye for graphics and for comic art.
And recognizing talent. He discovered a lot of people that went on to major things. And now here on an early page in the first Mad magazine, we see a face in the crowd here that Kurtzman discovered. He found a postcard on the wall of one of his editors, and he decided he liked that face a lot, and gradually it started showing up in Mad. And that was, of course, the What Me Worry Boy, who at first was not named Alfred E. Newman. He was called a couple other names first, and finally Alfred E. Newman stuck. And so this was when Harvey was in control, when he was editor of Mad. And they started doing things like making fun of advertising, because after the World War II, of course, consumerism was a big deal and a big push toward everybody buying products and improving their life. And here we have... they're improving their lives, all right. The baby is getting some beer, too. And he also had the idea of putting Mad reprints in paperbacks, and there had never been comic book work ever in a paperback book before Mad was in paperbacks. And it was a step up from comic books, even though paperbacks seem like they're kind of a crude thing, too. It really was a step up and quite a thing for Mad to be reprinted in paperbacks. And
at that point, almost anything was a step up from comics.
Well, true. But, you know, I mean, it was nobody else was getting this opportunity but him, and it was because he pushed it.
Now, the William M. Gaines on the top there, that's interesting.
Yeah, that...
Is there a story behind that?
You know, honestly, that might be a later addition.
Is that after he and Gaines had a split?
No, that's one of the that is one of the early Mads. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it might be a scan. They took Harvey's name off of the paperbacks, and they started putting Gaines' name on them. So this may be actually not the first edition. It's a collector's edition that was done later, I think.
Are you going to talk about the break between he and Gaines?
Well, I haven't put it on here because we're really talking about his work, but the thing about it is the break between why Harvey Kurtzman left MAD after just five magazine issues has been one of the most discussed, speculated about stories in the history of comics and publishing. Why in the world would someone walk away from something that was working so well, that was selling like crazy, that he was in complete creative control? Why did he leave? And so obviously it's a complicated question, and I spend an entire chapter of the book on it. And there, I found out things that no one's ever known about it before. So I'm not going to give them away now, but it was quite a thing for him to leave because what was Gaines going to do without Harvey? And it turned out he had somebody who could imitate Harvey pretty well, but not anything as good. But, yeah. In fact, this was Harvey Kurtzman's last issue of MAD, his spring issue, and after that, they were all edited by another fellow named Al Feldstein. But, you know, Feldstein made them look and feel so much like Kurtzman. I mean, he followed the Kurtzman template, so it's like, really, it was still an expression of Harvey Kurtzman in a way. Gradually, they got away from that, but for a long time, it was pretty hard to tell for most people that Kurtzman had even left. Because it was working so well. But he left partly to do a slick magazine. He wanted to do a color magazine, a fancy satire magazine. And he found somebody to publish that, Hugh Hefner. Hefner had just launched Playboy, was making money hand over fist, and Hefner loved MAD. So at one point they talked, and Hefner indicated, I'd sure like to do a magazine with you someday. And someday came pretty quick. And the first issue of Trump appeared in 1957, January 57.
And that help is prophetic in more than one way.
The help is prophetic in more than one way, but Trump had color inside. So it could have things like sporty illustrations that could make it really look like the magazine cover inside instead of just on the back cover. Or Hansel and Gretel could look like a Disney cartoon gone a little bit awry. And
wouldn't you say this was Harvey's ideal project?
Yes. He would have loved to have done Trump for the rest of his life, without question, because as a young boy, he wanted nothing more than to work in slick magazines. I mean, it really was the epitome of publishing if you're doing what he did, which is cartooning, illustration, satire. And unfortunately, Trump ended after just two issues. And suddenly he found himself, what happened was basically Hefner got himself in a cash crunch and said, well, we'll have to suspend it for a while, and it never came back. So Harvey was stuck figuring out what to do and what he decided.
We have now started the trajectory of Harvey's,
the rest of Harvey's career. The unfortunate trajectory, which is never getting things the way he wanted them, really, after he left MAD. But he did an awful lot of interesting things. And Humbug, which came next, was something that he self-published with several other people. And he was in complete creative control. And Humbug is superb work. Humbug is just as good as MAD. And I think it's one of the best-kept secrets about Harvey Kurtzman's career is just how wonderful Humbug is. It's for a little older audience. It's more like a college humor magazine. But, you know, we're all adults, so we could enjoy that. The end of the world is coming. Only 10 billion years left while waiting. Read Humbug for laughs. And you can see that Willie Elder signed there. He was he went with Harvey, along with several other artists, went with Harvey to work for Hefner and left MAD. Here again, Harvey's working with his layouts and the finished art. But you'll notice these layouts are a lot more complete. Here Harvey is really putting in all the expressions. It's a lot more than he did on the war comics. And then Willie Elder, of course, is making the characters look like they did in the movie and finishing the artwork.
Now, why do you think his layouts were... why do you think he made them more complete for Humbug than for the earlier stuff?
I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that, except that he was only doing Humbug. So he had the time, I guess. And also, Humbug, he didn't write all of Humbug. He had some of the people that worked with him, like Al Jaffe and Arnold Roth, they wrote their own pieces. So Kurtzman was so, sort of overseeing it, but really some of the other people were doing things, were doing writing too, which Harvey had written every word in the first 23 issues of Mad. He wasn't doing that with Humbug. And then after Humbug didn't make it, it's like, well, now what? And he ran into a guy named James Warren, who was publishing a ratty little magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And he said, Harvey, I have an idea for a magazine. And we'll just use photos from movies and anything we can find. And we'll put captions on them and we'll do a magazine called Help. After all, Harvey named it. And Help was kind of a hodgepodge. But he did meet some very interesting people at Help. And that's the key thing to know about that magazine. His assistant editor was a young woman named Gloria Steinem. It was her first job in publishing. He was her first boss. And he felt she could make anybody do anything. Everybody falls in love with her. When she talks to people on the phone, she can convince anybody of anything. And, you know, it turned out that she could be pretty compelling personality. And she had that even then. She could convince celebrities like Jerry Lewis to do a cover for free. And she also appeared in these little comic strips they called Fumettis, which were photographs with captions on them. It was a way of filling up more pages. But it became a very interesting little medium all its own. And Harvey would plot them out. He didn't write the script, but he'd have a photographer take the pictures while he stood by and kind of pointed them this way and that way. And then later, he would sit down and put the words to it. And some of them are not so good, but some of them are really good.
And you did those primarily for budgetary reasons, right?
Right, to fill pages. Because if you paid an artist to do those drawings, they could take the photographs in one day for an entire strip, but they couldn't. An artist couldn't draw those pages in one day, and so he'd need more money.
And Warren kept him on a tight budget.
And Warren kept him on a very tight budget because basically Warren didn't have any money anyway. He was just operating on credit. But Help is kind of an up and down affair, but he, in the process of working on it, he did invent something that was of enduring value, which is his character Goodman Beaver. And Goodman Beaver is somewhat based on the book by Voltaire, The Stories of Candide, you know, Dr. Pangloss, who believed we live in the best of all possible worlds. And Goodman Beaver always believed that everything is wonderful, and then he finds himself in situations that aren't so wonderful, and that's the basis of the humor. In this case, he's returning to his small town, and he's finding the Archie characters have become rather debauched. And this is Goodman goes playboy. He comes home and tells him, well, gee, you know, I think, you know, you should be reading Advice and Consent and The Affluent Society, and aren't these fascinating? And meanwhile, they're looking at a fold-out. And Goodman goes playboy, enraged the publishers of Archie Comics, and they sued them and collected money from Harvey. Had to pay money out of his pocket for that because they would not back down. And even though parody should be, should be legal to do parody, that hadn't really been proven in court yet. So Goodman Goes Playboy, however, led to something else. Hugh Hefner said, gee, you know, Goodman Beaver, well, I don't think that's quite right for Playboy. Maybe a girl version of Goodman Beaver. And so if you can see, the innocence of Goodman Beaver got translated, I guess, you know, it was translated into Little Annie Fanny. And Little Annie Fanny is something Kurtzman and Elder did for the next 28 years. And she was an innocent out in the world and encountering everybody who wanted to go to bed with her and a lot of other situations. For example, James Bond. And, you know, the strip was flawed. It could never really be satire because Hefner wanted her nude all the time. We don't have the nude panels here. But it still had its appeal for the readers of Mad. It's very popular, according to Hefner. It was very popular with the readers. But, you know, if you're a fan of Kurtzman, you have to believe that it's a very compromised effort. Commercialism really compromised it.
That's not a bad Sean Connery.
No, it's not bad. Well, what's your opinion, Gary, of Little Annie Fanny? What would be your assessment of Little Annie Fanny?
Well, I think Annie Fanny is an unfortunate 28-year span of Kurtzman's career. I interviewed Will Elder, and I reread all of the Annie Fannies as research for that. And there was a conventional critique of Annie Fanny that essentially said that the early episodes of Annie Fanny were good, and then it went downhill. And I thought it was pretty mediocre from the beginning and only got worse. I mean, it was never truly satiric. It just never had that edge or that bite that Mad or Humbug or Trump had. And even though Elder's painting was absolutely sumptuous, I mean, just stunning, and he made it work within the context of sequential storytelling, I really think it was just a kind of a waste of
his talent
of their 28 years.
Yeah. I pretty much agree with that also. But the other thing you have to remember is that his dream of working in Slick was to work in Slick magazines. And he was working in Playboy, and he was doing cartoon editing for Esquire. I mean, that was the epitome of working in magazines at that time. So, by his lights, he felt like he had at least reached that level of success, and that meant a lot to him, even if the work wasn't what we would hope it would be. But he met some people when he was working on Help and published their early work. One was Robert Crumb, who said, "The covers of Mad No. 11 and Humbug No. 2 changed the way I saw the world forever." Basically, Mad influenced Robert Crumb to the point that he reflected a lot of the satiric ideas and the approach, the kind of the wild and crazy approach, but it was filtered through Robert Crumb. It wasn't like Kurtzman exactly, but he inspired Crumb. He, in fact, Kurtzman published Crumb's with some early work by Crumb in Help. Help had some interesting things like this. And he also, of course, Crumb went on to do Zap Comics No. 1, which is like Action Comics No. 1 of underground comics.
You know, when I said earlier that I think Kurtzman is one of the best editors in the history of comics, when he was doing Help, I mean, he was looking for cheap material because he didn't have much of a budget to work with, but he published Crumb in 64
and 5.
I mean, before Crumb was Crumb, before he was truly an underground cartoonist to be reckoned with. And he also published other underground cartoonists like Gilbert Shelton. I think he published Skip Williamson, maybe Jay Lynch.
Jay Lynch, for sure.
So he found these guys. I mean, I'm not exactly sure how he found them, but I mean, they self-published
some comics.
Well,
what it is they got in touch with him and said, "We love you, Harvey. We want to work for you. Here's our samples. We're young cartoonists. Please, please, please." And he looked at their stuff and he wrote them encouraging letters, and they'd show up on his doorstep. Suddenly, they'd come to New York. You know, he'd open the door and it'd be Gilbert Sheldon saying, "Oh, Harvey, thanks for writing me that letter, and here I am." So,
but to see the quality in Crumb's work in 1964, I mean, that takes a really sharp eye.
That's right.
You know, I mean, because Crumb wasn't Crumb at the point.
That was the thing about him, is he had such an amazing taste and ability to work with very talented people. That was a big part of his talent, his own talent. And he even collaborated with Crumb on a strip. This appeared in the East Village Other, so you've got a Crumb panel next to a Kurtzman panel. And, of course, Crumb did his tribute to Kurtzman. You're a nutcase, Crumb.
Now, Crumb almost went to work for Harvey at Help. Mm-hmm. And there's a funny story behind that, which is that I think Crumb was, tell me if I'm going wrong any of this, but Crumb was working at a greeting card company in Cleveland, Ohio. And he talked to Harvey, and Harvey said, "I'd like to work and be my assistant at Help." And so Crumb was elated. He moved lock, stock, and barrel to New York. And he walked into the Help offices, which were the Warren offices, and he saw people moving furniture out. And I guess the day before that, Warren had canceled the magazine. And so Crumb walked in, and Harvey just looked at him and said, "I'm sorry, you don't have a job."
Yeah, but Harvey did find him work.
He did.
In New York, tried to make it up to him, but
Crumb was not suited for that work.
But that work was not exactly. It wasn't what Crumb wanted to do.
He worked. Crumb worked as, among other things, as Jack Davis's assistant.
Really? Now that I didn't know.
Yeah, and he couldn't keep up. He said Davis was doing like 5 assignments at the same time. He was running from like, you know, several different rooms. He was at, you know, running to Xerox machines. He was drawing in one room, and Crumb's head was just, you know, exploding at this because, I mean, Crumb's very slow, very methodical, very careful.
Right. And Davis was one of the fastest.
Yeah, he was like a machine.
Yeah. Well, eventually Crumb did zap, of course, and the rest is history. And then there's another cartoonist who was very influenced by Harvey Kurtzman. That's Art Spiegelman. And as you probably know, his graphic novel Mouse won a special Pulitzer Prize. And he said, Harvey Kurtzman has been the single most significant influence on a couple of generations of comics artists. So that's pretty clear that he felt that Kurtzman influenced him and influenced Mouse indirectly. So we even got Terry Gilliam to do an introduction, so we're very happy about that. And that ends the slideshow.
And why did we get Terry Gilliam to do the introduction?
Well, Terry Gilliam was Kurtzman's last assistant editor on Help. And he actually was the one who came from L.A. after Harvey wrote him a nice letter and showed up on his doorstep in New York. And Harvey's going, what the hell are you doing here? But Terry Gilliam proved to be a very good assistant editor, and of course he's obviously a very resourceful guy. He ended up doing Monty Python, of course, and he was a major film director. And he loves Harvey's work, and he was willing to do this just to help the book. And so that's how much he felt for Harvey. Why would Terry Gilliam take the time to do an introduction for us except for that? And I'm very happy about that. And he wrote a nice one, a nice introduction. So that's the end of the slideshow. Maybe there are questions. We can talk about some other things. Michelle?
Bill, when I knew Harvey in the early 70s, I asked him a couple times about politics and man. Talk a little about, if you can, how he foreshadowed and in some ways created the counterculture. Of course, you've already talked about Crumb, but the thing is, the teachers in my elementary school and middle school, they hated Mad because they saw it as a left-wing tool, because they were all right-wing nutcases, they saw it as a left-wing tool. So can you talk a little bit about the politics of Kurtzman?
Well, you know, after World War II, everybody was, the government and media and everybody tried to get the American people all walking and thinking in lockstep. And the reason Mad was so successful is because it showed an alternate view, and we've got 5 more minutes, so we don't have a lot of time. But basically, it began that kind of questioning that eventually became part of the mindset of youth in America, the counterculture. In fact, cartoonist R.C. Harvey is quoted as saying that really, you could almost believe that Mad, if it hadn't been for Mad, you know, that Mad had something to do with the anti-war protests in the 60s, that somehow that questioning attitude spread, and until it got to the point where it really had changed American history in some ways. And I think that there's definitely something to it. You can't say Mad ended the Vietnam War, but...
I mean, the curious thing is, Harvey was not a very political guy.
No.
He was sort of a post-war liberal, middle-of-the-road liberal, probably more of a Humphrey than McGovern kind of guy.
Yeah.
Jules Pfeiffer once told me that he never cared for Mad because it wasn't political, by which I think he meant it wasn't ideological.
Right.
But it was culturally subversive.
It was culturally
political
subversive.
Per se.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It crossed all boundaries, really, in that sense.
Yeah, it was a big influence, actually, on Mad Men. There's a quote by Matthew Weiner just saying how it wasn't afraid to make fun of that time, make fun of the alcoholism, but also kind of the glamour. So it's still influencing our culture today.
Thank you for coming, and I'd just like to say that I spent 4 years working on this. I put everything I had into it, and I think that I've never worked on a project that I enjoyed more, was more rewarding, and I am prouder of. So I hope you like the book, and I'm really excited about it coming out. It's going to be out in about a month.
Wait, do you know when it's coming?
It'll be out in about 6 to 8 weeks. It'll be available in bookstores. And I'm very proud to have published it. It is a great book.
Yeah, and Gary was the one that said, hey, how about a book on Kurtzman?
Little did I know.
This guy was the one that suggested it.
So. You have 3 more minutes if you want to take more questions.
Okay, okay,
one more.
I just have a question. I was wondering what you found out or what you were able to think about his parents and their life as Russian Jews from Odessa, and also whether Kurtzman had any ties to the Yiddish language leftist press.
Harvey was one of the Jews, a Jewish boy in America who really didn't want to be perceived as different. And so he really didn't have anything to do with the Yiddish press or anything like that. He really, his father converted to Christian Science. Yeah. And so I think that... Did you want to answer some more about that? His parents
were the expert on that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I found out things that nobody's ever known about them.
There are plenty of secular Jews who are still involved in the leftist press.
Yeah, right. You're right. But he wasn't. The main thing he got from his parents, who were communists, was his anti-racist views and his pro-union views. Those are the two things that he got from them. The rest of it, no. But those are pretty indicative of his heart was in the right place.
Did he speak Yiddish?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. At home, they did. Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Anyone else have another question?
Before, yes, sir. Before we stop.
I had always heard that the split over Mad had to do with Harvey wanting part ownership of the magazine and Gaines refusing.
Well, it's a very complicated thing, but basically at a certain point, Harvey felt like he'd built up Mad, and Gaines was making all the money. And even though the agreement was he was working on a work-for-hire basis, he just, at any point in time when you work for someone, you can renegotiate what the deal is. I mean, there's no law that says he can't try to say, look, let's figure out something a little more equitable here. And he was working on that, and then things kind of spun out of control. Yeah.
But it was Harvey's decision to leave.
Absolutely. It was. Gaines was bereft and was going to just stop Mad. You figure, no way I can do it without Harvey.
The second worst decision in the history of comics.
Yeah. Hefner? There's some truth to that. I think that's Feldstein's opinion. He doesn't know. I included what Harvey said about that in the book. The things he said about it didn't really say that he was trying to get fired. He never admitted that, let's say. It's a matter of interpretation, do you think? From the actions that I set down in the book, do you think he was trying to get fired? You decide.
It's almost more like he might have been willing to be fired.
Having
given Gaines his ultimatum, he'd be willing to take the consequences and move on.
Yeah, I mean, what I tried to do is give you the information and you can come to your own conclusion. I think that's a better way to present some of this stuff rather than to say, I know. Well, some things the author doesn't know.
I think it was such a bitter experience that Harvey didn't want to talk about it later years. Do you think
he talked about it, but less and less.
Yeah.
And when he was asked years later if he regretted leaving Mad, he said no. And I don't think he did. I think ultimately he had made peace with the decision to leave. He wasn't a shattered person. It's just that, here's a guy with this great talent, and it's such a waste that he wasn't able to really do work at that level that he should have been working. That's the real sad part. But anyway, on that upbeat note, thank you for coming.
We are out of time.
I think we are out of time.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.